You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of May 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
The enduring characteristic of the British is fairness and generosity of spirit. I believe that people will just turn away from Labour's politics of social division.
With hours to go until polls open in the UK's general election, former Prime Minister Sir John Major warns, unsurprisingly, that a Labour-led government in general, and one involving the Scottish National Party in particular, could tear Britain apart. Is he right? My studio guests Xenia Wickett and Shashank Joshi will give us their take. Also ahead, Republican presidential hopeful Senator Ted Cruz has already made Obama bashing something of a motif.
We need to abolish the IRS. We need to repeal every word of Obamacare.
Etc. But will blaming the president for Sunday's Texas terrorist attack prove a little too far-fetched, even for the reddest of the red states? Plus, is there any hope left for NBC's Brian Williams? And why are cheeseburgers and Happy Meals no longer the golden McNugget for one famous fast food behemoth? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. My guests today are Xenia Wickett, Project Director at the US Programme at Chatham House, and Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. I should state to viewers, if it seems that Shashank, at least in the early stages, is being uncharacteristically quiet, it is in fact because he's not here due to the vicissitudes of London transport. But we are hoping he will be with us in extremely short order. So, for the moment, it is just me and Xenia, but I'm sure that will be more than enough. We will start here in Britain, where 24 hours from now the people will be voting, and 48 hours from now, if the polls are to be believed, Britain's politicians will be beginning what might be a lengthy process of assembling a government that reflects the results. One warning from history appeared in today's Daily Telegraph, a newspaper which appears persuaded that any kind of Labour government will instantly reduce Britain to squalid Hobbesian feudalism. An op-ed by Sir John Major, the last Conservative leader to actually win an election, warns that Labour could wreck the country no less. Xenia, he says, and I do, it's all getting too silly, he actually says the stakes could not be higher. A man who has forgotten the entire 1940s, clearly. Is this actually as mad as it sounds?
What isn't mad? I'm just back from DC. I was in DC last week, and I have, over the last few days, been getting numerous emails from my friends in the US. There is real fear in the US and elsewhere that that the UK is essentially becoming an irrelevance. That, you know, defense spending is going down, that the UK is very focused inward, that the UK isn't really ready or willing or able to step up and engage internationally as we are used to it doing. The trouble is that from the American perspective, they look at both candidates, both lead candidates, Conservatives and Labour, and kind of go, well, on the one hand, we have a choice of a leader who wants to hold a referendum on whether the UK should be in the EU, which from an American perspective is a horrific thought that the UK would leave the EU. And on the other hand, we want a leader who may actually link up with the SNP, and you may see a devolution within the UK. Also, a very bad scenario. So from some perspective, yes, the external view on the elections is this is really serious in a way that we haven't seen before.
Because if you were looking at it from the American perspective, I guess what would seem serious to them is what has not been a factor in this entire campaign, which is that there has barely been 3 seconds discussion of foreign policy.
And there never is. I mean, and again, you look at the American elections, we're already in election season in the United States with, about 18 months to go. And the reality is even in the middle of Iraq, even in the middle of Afghanistan, foreign policy just isn't an election issue. And it's not an election issue because the British people, the American people, vote on what they feel to be in their own direct personal interest rather than in, what's in the interests of the world. And so in the end, they care about economy, jobs, healthcare, very, very personal issues. Foreign policy just isn't an issue. But if you're sitting outside the United Kingdom, you know, I would almost make an argument that John Major's comments are more relevant for an external audience than an internal audience. Because the idea that we're going to have another coalition government that is going to be either led by the by the Labour Party, which could lead to a split in the UK, or the Conservatives, which could lead to exiting the EU, although I will say both of those are quite unlikely, but at least there's a possibility, that then creates a scenario that is far more serious than we have seen in many, many years.
So John Major's philippic struck me as odd on a couple of other points. It is mostly a harangue about the economic probity of Conservatives, but coming from a man who presided over Black Wednesday and 15% interest rates, I'm not really sure how terrifically keen I am to listen to any of that. But does he have the one point at which I thought he does have half a point, and this may be because I'm missing something because I'm not British and there's a whole area of British class angst I just do not comprehend. The sort of the incredible tribal hatred that seeps into British politics, and I think increasingly has in recent years. It exists in Australia, but not in the same intensity. But he does make the point that not all Conservatives are rich. It is not exclusively a party of braying public school educated toffs. There is this real sort of this cartoonish division which seems starker than ever between the two parties.
And again, I think that's happening. You're seeing something like this play out in different ways across Europe and in the United States to a large degree. I mean, you know, when from an American perspective, the class warfare, when I lived in the United States and I would say, you know, oh, yes, they're middle upper or they're upper middle class. And people would look at me like, what on earth are you talking about? But of course, here, growing up in the UK, that was a kind of characterization that we understood. But if you go to Europe, I mean, there's this, and this we are really seeing kind of play out to some extent over the last few months and even today and the election tomorrow. There's a real populist trend across Europe. You know, Marine Le Pen in Paris, in France. You know, this idea, Wilders in Belgium. You know, this idea that actually migrants, the non-national is bad, immigration is bad, we shouldn't have any visitors come into our shores. And that you're very much seeing that play out in the election. You've got UKIP, which is all about, in very large part, trying to stop immigration. You've got the kind of the conservative anti-Europe group that it very much sees it as, If they're European laws, they can't be British laws, and they can't be right for us. And so you really are seeing this trend play out in the election of this group, this kind of populist group, that if, you know, us versus them, and them are bad.
Has it struck you that the tone of the media coverage generally has been unusually apocalyptic in this election? I mean, and I don't just mean, you know, Britain's, traditionally rumbustious tabloids, but even the Daily Telegraph, in which John Major's op-ed appears, and for readers unacquainted with it, it is traditionally a very staid, sensible broadsheet, the preferred breakfast reading of retired colonels in the home counties. But its headline today is Nightmare on Downing Street. It has the door of number 10 painted red, Nicola Sturgeon, the leader of the SNP, sort of waving from the window. Now, it just strikes me as mad, because whatever reservations one might have about Ed Miliband, should he end up Prime Minister, it does not mean that we're all going to end up, you know, sort of singing the Internationale on collective farms this time next month. I mean, it's weird. It's got very strange, I think, this campaign.
Well, I think that's more about the media than anything else. I think every 4 years or every 5 years, we think that this time it's worse. and the reality is that every election, it seems that much worse. I think what is different in this election, and to some extent you started to see in the last election, but not at the same degree at all, is we no longer have a two-party system here. You know, we have a multi-party system.
And the media hasn't really figured that out yet, has it?
And the media hasn't necessarily figured that out, but what that means is the complexity. I mean, what I find really interesting, and again, kind of looking at this, because of course the US has pretty much a two-party system as well, but most of Europe doesn't. You know, what I find really interesting is if you're listening to the rhetoric of the leaders, you know, including John Major in this Telegraph article, they're all saying, don't vote for them because they're going to partner with these completely outrageous people and you're no longer going to get a Labour policy or a Conservative policy. You're going to get a UKIP policy or an SNP policy. And so there really is this kind of sense of, it's almost as though the two principal parties are so close together that actually the only way to differentiate is to tie them to this extreme left-right voice. And that's the way you're going to beat them. And you're seeing both parties do that in a way that I suspect is quite damaging. And, of course, the media are picking up on that.
Well, as you mentioned, you're just back from DC, which moves us along to, on the subject of polities, also unable to discuss anything without descending into posturing partisan rancour. Now, it's almost as if there is nothing for which the more foam-flecked cohorts of the Republican Party cannot blame President Barack Obama personally. Senator Ted Cruz has decided to blame the president for Sunday's shooting at an anti-Muslim conference in Dallas, because obviously Islamist terror attacks on United States soil will never happen when Republicans are in charge. Zania, the first thing that occurred to me is that given that the two gunmen were fairly swiftly shot dead, you would think Cruz would be pleased, wouldn't you?
You might be, but that's not what this is about. I mean, you have to remember, American politics, sad to say, is, you know, as I said, we're already in an election campaign. We're 18 months from the election, but we're already in the election campaign. And right now, American politics is so divisive, is so partisan, that anything that is Democrat is bad. Anything that is Obama is bad. And you're even seeing it to some extent, you know, Hillary working very, very hard to separate herself, Hillary Clinton, who's, you know, almost certainly going to be the Democratic nominee, separate herself from Obama, despite the fact that she was Secretary of State for 4 years under President Obama. And then you're also seeing, you know, if that weren't bad enough, this huge division between the Democrat and the Republican Party, where anything that the other side proposes is bad, that's compounded by the fact that you've now, I think, got six Republicans running, and you will almost certainly have probably another, you know, few add to the mix, maybe another six add to the mix. And of those who are running, unlike 4 or 8 years ago, actually, certainly 4 years ago, they're actually pretty credible. They all do represent slightly different factions within the Republican Party. They all have strong, robust careers. It's not a Herman Cain who, you know, ran a pizza.
Herman Cain.
We remember with great fondness, you know, who ran a pizza company or a franchise for however many years. These are people who are former governors or senators who are really credible. And so they have to now differentiate amongst themselves. And so you do get, if anything, some people like Ted Cruz, who was fairly, I'm trying to find, you know, extreme, move to even further extremes to differentiate himself from the competition.
But this is what occurs to me, or at least what occurred to me when listening to an outburst as patently bonkers as this latest one by Cruz has been, which is just that it just strikes me that the Republicans appear to have learnt absolutely nothing from 2012, which is they've ended up in this situation where you can't get the GOP nomination unless you spend 2 years pretending to be insane. And then by the time you actually get the nomination by having pretended to be insane, you've completely alienated all the centre ground voters you need to win the White House.
So I had lunch with what I would call a moderate Republican the day of the 2012 election. And over the course of lunch, he said, you know, my greatest fear is that if the Republicans lose, that the party will choose to perceive this because we were too moderate, not because we were too extreme. And unfortunately, that fear has come to pass in some parts of the party. You know, what's really interesting is, you know, on the one hand, you have Ted Cruz, you have Rand Paul, who represents another different faction of the Republican Party.
Different being a charitable way,
you know,
of putting
it. You have Marco Rubio, who's, you know, ever so slightly further in if you were going to kind of draw a circle. You know, But you also have Jeb Bush. Now, he hasn't actually put his name forward, but here's a man who actually is reasonably conservative, but on a couple of really key issues, like immigration, like education, he doesn't toe the party line. Now, that is fascinating, because we haven't seen that at this point before, that you'd actually have a credible candidate, fairly centrist, who actually says, you know what, I'm going to differentiate myself within the party by actually staying moderate. Now, whether he holds to that line over the next year in an attempt to get, as he attempts to get the Republican nomination, I don't know. But at the moment, he's held to it pretty firmly.
What do you think the basic problem with the Republicans is? Because you mentioned that you're speaking to a moderate Republican, and what gets missed, I think, in the coverage of American politics from this side of the Atlantic is that there's many, many millions of those people. And once you travel outside the big cities in the United States, you meet people who describe themselves as Republicans, and they strike you as, because they are decent, reasonable, bright people who believe in things like individual liberty and accountability and perfectly reasonable things, and understand that quite a lot of the people who end up at the forefront of their party are howling at the moon, frankly. We actually had William Kristol on one of our programs before the last election, who conceded entirely that point. We were all set up to do a confrontational interview with the GOP kingmaker about the paucity of the Republican field, and he just went, yeah, I know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what I've been saying about the Republican or the American politics for really the last 3 or 4 years is there aren't three parties, and maybe we can now bring it back to the British elections. There aren't three parties at the moment. There are four parties. You have the Democratic Party that is relatively coherent today. You have the centrist Republicans, of which I would say Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, some of the possible candidates sit in that tranche, if you will. And then you have the Tea Party Republicans. Now, these are not really fair examples, because there are arguably some Tea Partiers who actually flip the whole way around to being Democrat again. But and the Tea Party Republicans, as Ted Cruz being one, Marco Rubio to some extent being one, some form of one, Rand Paul, again, he's not really Tea Party, but nevertheless, he's some form of one. There are three parties at the moment. And so that what people are being asked to choose from is from that collection of three, not from a collection of two, which is how we tend to characterize American politics. And the only other thing, this is not new. I mean, this trend of parties to seem to divide but not quite and then come back together, this has been going on for decades in the United States, but we tend to forget it.
Just finally on this one, does it strike you that the Republicans are yet to figure out that you can't win the White House by just being the party of middle-aged white guys? There's not enough left. There's not enough of them left.
Again, listen to Jeb Bush. He knows it. There are people within the Republican Party who know it and understand it, and as such, their policy on immigration is fundamentally different. Their policy on some key issues is fundamentally different, including inequality and things of that nature.
Well, we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Zania Wickett. We are still hoping that Shashank Joshi will make an appearance before the end of the program. But coming up after a very short break, we will be wondering whether there is any way back for two floundering American institutions, Brian Williams and McDonald's.
With cutting-edge commentary, long-form articles, and fresh thinking from the Monocle editorial team, The Forecast is a new annual packed with key insights into the year ahead. We've commissioned a range of correspondents, business minds, historians, urbanists, and diplomats to offer their views on everything from balance-shifting defence systems to fresh benchmarks in city planning. With presentation paramount, The Forecast's mix of assessments, photo essays, illustrated portfolios and reportage are put together across more than 240 pages of fine finish paper to provide an essential companion for 2015.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me is Zania Wickett. Still not with me is Shashank Joshi, but we are hopeful. We'll move along now to the brouhaha which engulfed NBC News anchor Brian Williams in February. It was a definitive American scandal involving, as it did, a riotously overpaid news anchor, a hilariously disproportionate response to a minor lie about a war founded on rather bigger ones, and an epically pompous self-regarding response by the rest of America's media. But there has been recently some suggestion that there might be a way back for him at the end of his six-month suspension. Zania, there was some suggestion that some at NBC wanted him back in the anchor's chair. Is that the right place for him?
I don't know. I mean, America's one of the characteristics, I suppose, of whether we're talking about politics or we're talking about fame, media, we have a tendency to condemn anything that's not white as white. You know, if somebody had an affair 20 years ago,
we remember one person for the worst thing they've ever done
exactly.
or said.
And it doesn't necessarily have to have any reflection on the job we're asking them to do. We hold people up to standards that are so much higher than we do everybody else in a way that probably isn't terribly practical. And this is yet one case. You know, Brian Williams, you can make an argument, as many have done, that he lied. And therefore, you know, in our news readers, we need nothing but the pristine truth. At the same time, he's an individual and, you know, people make mistakes. And did he find himself going down a route where somebody misunderstood him and he didn't correct them at that time? And then it went further and he thought, that's, you know, what I just at this point, it's embarrassing to correct. I don't know how this was caused.
I mean, I formed this sort of impression that he told the kind of slightly embellished whopper that journalists tell each other in hotel bars all the time. It's just that he did it in public in his guise as a news anchor. But what struck me was the reaction of the American media. And in the same way that they did with Jason Blair, with Stephen Glass, it just becomes this
we love to see people fall.
But a British media organisation, maybe The Independent went close with this with the Johan Hari scandal. But by and large, in Britain, you'd probably just quietly fire the guy, apologise and move on. It wouldn't turn into this epic production in 10 acts.
But we love the rise and fall. I mean, you know, maybe this is about the American dream in part. You know, the American dream, this idea that you can come from nothing into something. You know, this is a rhetoric that Marco Rubio uses all the time. You know, mother, I think a barmaid, father, I don't remember. But, you know, this idea that you can rise to riches, you can rise to become potentially president of the United States, but equally you can fall. And that's a very, very important part of the American psyche, that you can do that. So maybe it's that we love to watch that fall.
But the thing is, he's just a newsreader, isn't he? I mean, there's not a shortage in America of middle-aged white guys with nice hair and nice teeth who can read an auto cue.
Yes, but on the one hand, absolutely. But, you know, he's somebody we see every single day. People who watch, you know, who watch NBC News, this is the man that they trust. This is a figure like a sportsman is. And I think that, you know, I mean, that's true here in the UK as well. There is this kind of love of the media figure who we respect. You know, Martin Wolf of the FT, you know, writing Economist. You know, we either love him or hate him, but we respect him. You know, I think there's this a similar kind of, in the British way, there's a similar kind of holding people on a pedestal.
Do you think that aura still exists for newsreaders in the same way that might have in the pre-online age, though?
Probably less so, but it also exists less so because we now know about all their foibles. You know, in the past, you didn't. You know, it's the same, you know, you couldn't have, Kennedy couldn't be a president today.
Indeed not.
Given media.
And also, I guess, in the past, journalists could get away with stuff because there wasn't an internet full of people waiting to catch them.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Well, moving along again, if Williams is finished, it is especially poor timing, as one traditional avenue of employment for those trying to find their way back may be narrowing. McDonald's, which has been doing badly for some time, or at least not as well as it has been accustomed to doing, is not doing much better. Its newest chief executive, Steve Easterbrook, has acknowledged that the company is not on its game. Adding to its woes, the EU is investigating claims that McDonald's avoided paying slightly over €1 billion in corporation tax. Zania, there have been doing this thing in recent years and of trying to appear healthier, of trying to, which just, just from my own point of view, it just struck me as fundamentally misguided. It's not what you go to McDonald's for, is it?
Well, so this is it, you know, and you're seeing this, actually, we were talking about the media earlier, you're seeing this in the media. There are new technologies that are, the world is changing faster and faster and faster, and then new technologies are supporting these change, whether it's new media technologies, a new understanding about food and food groups, et cetera, et cetera. And so companies are often ignoring that and saying we can stick with what we've got. And of course, falling by the wayside often, as many of the media companies are struggling more and more to actually continue to get to have their model work of advertising revenues. Or in the food companies, essentially saying either we'll stick with what we've got, or we're going to try and make some changes to reflect the new health craze, the new desire to know what how many calories are in every mouthful of you know, Big Macs. But, you know, you look at what McDonald's, and this is what the share price is saying, is they ain't got it. You know, they haven't actually figured out whether they're going to keep with the model, as you say, which is, you know what, you go for McDonald's not for a healthy meal. You go for, you know, McDonald's because you want something quick and fast and greasy with,
and
you
know. And you're massively hungover.
And you're massively hungover. You know, they're trying to walk that middle line and, you know, as the share price suggests, failing.
I was struck as something of a connoisseur. I like to think of myself as of corporate gobbledygook by Easterbrook's press release when he said, as we look to shape McDonald's future as a modern progressive burger company, and I'll just let that phrase hang there for a couple of seconds, our priorities are threefold. Driving operational growth, okay, fine. Returning excitement to our brand, yeah, and unlocking financial value. Two of those, I have no idea what they mean. That's the operational growth, financial value, etc. What do you think he might mean by returning excitement to our brand?
Well, I mean, he has a couple of statements that are along that line where you kind of go, seriously? You know, does that mean that you're going to find, you know, nail clippings in your hamburger or, you know, and what is excitement?
That's a sort of excitement.
That's a sort of excitement. I don't think that's, I suspect that's not what he had in mind. I mean, here's the thing. You know, they get 69 million daily customers. I mean, that's a pretty significant number. And so you kind of go, somebody likes out there, actually likes and appreciate what they get for, you know, very relatively low cost. They get a, you know, very large, unhealthy meal. Why they're not, you know, and there's some comments about branding. You know, what is he trying to achieve with his branding? And it's unclear. And I think, you know, you've put your finger on it, which is he doesn't actually know what he's doing. He just knows what's being done isn't right.
You do get these weird moments of corporate hubris, though, where a successful company decides that being successful is not enough. And it tries going chasing off this other audience, or which may or may not even exist. New Coke being only the most famous example.
But here's you know, the reality is that I think that with the new food groups, the new desire to be healthy, the fact that we're now tying up insurance with what you eat and whether you go to the gym or not, you know, and so you can cut costs. I mean, there are all sorts of trends that are taking place that mean we are eating different things. McDonald's can either say we're happy with a smaller market share.
And smaller, as you point out, is an extremely relative term.
It's still going to be a very, very large number. Or they can say we're going to try and transform ourselves to something that we're not. Whether they're actually able to do that or not, I think, is a very, very big question.
Is this discussion making you hungry in the slightest?
No.
We will leave it there on that note. Zania Wickett, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. Apologies for the non-attendance of Shashank Joshi from Roosie, on which we are going to blame the Bakerloo line, but Shashank will doubtless be appearing regularly on future programmes. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Rylan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Sara Moneta and Caroline Hamargren, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half an hour, Josh Fennett will be keeping you company with Monocle's International Playlist. At 1900 hours, it's Daniel Giacopelli with The Entrepreneurs. At 2200, I'm back with Emma Nelson for The Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time on Election Day here in the UK. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thank you very much for listening.